Greetings from the Southern Cohort of the 2019 UC Coros System-Wide Leadership Collaborative. Our project is entitled Best Practices for Leading Campus and System-Wide Change Projects. Our deliverables include the production of podcast interviews with influential people in the area of change management, theory, and application. This interview session is being conducted with Chief Information Officers from four UC campuses.
My name is Christian Villasenor. I work here in the Executive Vice Chancellor's Office at UC Santa Barbara as the Director for Academic Administration.
So hello, everyone. I'm Terry Wimbush. I'm the Director of Labor Relations and Employee Relations for the UC San Diego campus.
Next, our interview participants introduced themselves and briefly discussed their experience with change management.
My name is Matt Hall. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for IT and Chief Information Officer at UC Santa Barbara. So this all goes all the way back to the Florida legislature, where we had one of the first change initiatives I've ever done was a House electronic bill system, where we introduced the House of Representatives of Florida. We introduced how to do this electronically to large systems and mergers and acquisitions with Bank of America, CPOE systems in healthcare, which is computerized physician order entry systems, and basically how they do healthcare from paper to electronic, and now large scale systems that we've all gone through with UCPath. So very large systems in a lot of different industries.
Next, Anne Kowalczyk introduced herself.
I'm Associate Vice Chancellor CIO at UC Merced. I would say that my experience with change management really goes back to the mid-90s when I took my first position in a higher ed environment in an IT organization, where my focus was on helping people adopt and use technologies for teaching and learning and research. And since then, you know, the last, I guess it's been 30 years, technologies have changed so dramatically and so consistently. And my role has largely been to go into higher ed institutions and build organizational capacity to deliver technology services and resources. And the issues now are no longer really around getting people to adopt technology. They're more around helping institutions leverage technology strategically. So I feel like I've worked in change initiatives sort of at a very micro people-to-people level, as well as more broadly in terms of managing organizational, you know, needs and capacity and so forth. I'll add that my academic background is in anthropology and instructional design. So I really think about both the social and cognitive forces that either impede or facilitate change. And I draw on that one in terms of how I approach change in my work.
Tom Andreola, System-Wide Chief Information Officer here at the university. My background with change started pretty early, where I did a very deep dive as part of my master's program into understanding organizational change. Spent several years in consulting, bringing change in the form of people, process, and technologies. Ran a very large business transformation program for a global multinational, where we were assimilating multiple acquisitions and building a common business blueprint to run the business around the world. Then a variety of other situations where, as a general manager of software businesses, really instituting disruptive business models into the healthcare space. So it feels like, you know, every time I've been involved in something, there's been an element of there's a way things have been, there's a way that we're trying to get things to be for the future. And it's been much less about the technology, which generally works. It's really about how to get the organizational, and I like Ann's term, the capacity to adapt to changing environments and to kind of reset what the organization is trying to accomplish.
Chris Longhurst. I am a faculty member, a practicing physician, and serve as the CIO for UC San Diego Health and the Associate Chief Medical Officer for Quality and Safety. I have been at UC San Diego for just shy of 4 years, and prior to that was at another academic medical center for about 15 years. It's really where I got my formal and informal training in change management. I was hired fresh out of my residency training to help lead a project around physician order entry. And we actually had the good fortune of hiring an external change management expert to come in and facilitate a couple years worth of training sessions. His name is Dr. Jerry Jellison, and he's a famous author of the J-Curve, Management of Change. And so I'm a student of his and a big fan of his model towards change, which I've used repeatedly over the years, including the last 4 years here in San Diego.
And you touched on this a little bit in your introduction, the people side of change management. You talked about how your academic background has assisted you. I was wondering, maybe you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're probably all familiar with the Everett Rogers diffusion model of change, which kind of talks about change at a sociological level. And I want to look into Chris's mention of this J model, because that sounds interesting. I've often found it very useful to use a model that I call stages of concern. And it sort of focuses on change at the individual level. So the sociological perspective is helpful, but it's individuals who often need to make the very discrete, concrete change. And the stages of concern model assumes it's like six steps that really range from, first is to really build awareness. And then it continues through five more stages to the highest stage, which is that, you know, the ability to make a change is really about refocusing and repurposing your perspective, your resources or whatnot. And it's similar to the ADKAR model as well. But I think that we often forget when we're making a change or promoting a change that we don't always cause change. Change happens sort of regardless of what we do. We're not necessarily human agents of change. Change is kind of a thing that goes on anyway, always. And our job is sort of to help influence the direction of things that are happening anyway, whether we're doing something or not. And often that's around people getting on the same page with a shared awareness of the impact of the change. And I think it's easy to underestimate how long that can take, particularly in an environment where there's always a sense of urgency. So I found it very useful to really slow things down and kind of confirm with people, with colleagues and stakeholders and so forth, to really make sure we're developing intentionally that shared understanding about the impact of a change.
We have an inertia, an object at rest remains at rest until acted upon by an outside force. So maybe Chris would be better to speak to this than me, but the regulatory landscape can move an individual and organization to change. We had a thing in what drove us to CPOE, a lot of it is something called meaningful use. There were regulatory landscape changes that occurred, but there were certain regulatory issues, whether it was an efficiency thing. Did that move? No. Did they really think that document and patient interoperability was useful? Maybe. So I'm curious how Chris would view that on the people side from the regulatory space. But I think the least beneficial thing is it's hard for people to move off their inertial state just by perceiving a benefit. Is there a positive benefit for change? People are very skeptical that there's a benefit. So how do you prove there's a benefit? How do you illustrate that there's a benefit to the change? Or do you have a command and control where you're going to change? It's something as simple at the people level. When I was at a small sheriff's office, we had 400 sworn officers. One of the basic changes, and it sounds trivial, the sheriff said two things. You can no longer wear turtlenecks, and you have to wear your patrol hat if you're going to go out and make a traffic stop. That was a riot amongst the deputies who had to absorb those changes for that sheriff. And it's what's in it for me is the question. So at a personal level, what's in it for me and what are the external forces, whether they're regulatory, whether they're a perceived benefit, or whether they're a command and control? Those are the way the people react to the change is based upon where the source of the change emerges from.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That stages of concern model I mentioned, the second one is relevance. You've really got to help people understand how the change is relevant to them. And sometimes that relevance, I mean, you're lucky if it's a positive change, but often change has a unintended negative consequence, I think, and we'll ignore that. And that's probably the wrong thing to do. You've got to really help people understand that impact in terms of its immediate relevance to their life, what they value, what they're experiencing, whether it's good or bad.
The comment I would make, we were rolling out physician order entry at the Children's Hospital at my previous organization back in 2004 or five, long before the meaningful use regulatory change. And what really inspired a lot of CPOE rollouts was the Institute of Medicine report that suggested across the United States, 100,000 patients die every year of medical errors. And that was data that was extrapolated from some studies. So people argued about it, of course. But at the end of the day, it was very clear that the medical system set up to help patients was itself unintentionally harming patients. And so as you lead an organization through a massive change, like doctors are no longer going to write orders, they're going to enter those orders electronically so they're legible, and we eliminate the waste of faxing orders and things like that. It was important that there was a shared recognition of why that change was occurring. It wasn't because computerizing something was cool or saved the hospital money. It was because of the potential to decrease patient harm. And we really were able to get a lot of buy-in to something that was very difficult to do because of that shared mission. I want to comment on something else that was said. You know, it doesn't really matter what model I think you use around change. There's an important point that change happens, and you know, you do your best to manage that change, but you can't avoid some of the consequences of the change. You know, there's going to be a certain level of fear, anger, self-doubt when change begins to occur. There can be negative consequences, largely unintended, and, you know, discouraged sort of responses. I think our job as leaders is to help minimize some of those unintended responses. How can you shorten that change curve by better setting expectations, by listening to stakeholders, by managing, you know, projects in a way that delivers value quickly or gets resistors on board early? All of these strategies for managing change help to change the curve, but they don't eliminate all the responses to change.
Yeah, I want to piggyback on that a little bit, right? Because change is a very individual thing at a certain level. Now, everyone has to experience the change in their own way. And as you know, as I've moved into leadership positions, trying to help organizations change, it strikes me how much I've learned over the years about understanding how each individual is experiencing this change, how to read the signs about the organization's momentum towards that change, the things that I can do, the levers that I can pull from a leadership position to help the change gain momentum or to provide air cover to some of those early adopters who want to step forward and take a risk around a change we'd like to see happen. You know, how do you help those people succeed and protect them from the organizational antibodies? How do you focus on, you know, when you're going through change, is the common, you've got 20% of the people who get it immediately to jump on board. You have 20% of the people who dig their heels in and no matter what you do are just not going to buy in. But the 60% of the people in the middle that they call the fence sitters, how do you focus your energy and your messaging on them so in such a way they fall to the side that you want the organizational to move to? There's just a lot that I've learned as I've moved up in organizations from being the one doing a lot of the pushing towards tomorrow towards trying to help the organization balance between respecting the current state, but creating the compelling rationale for why we need to move to somewhere different.
Most of you talked about experience outside of the UC system too. And I'm just curious, for those of you who worked in the private industry, how you see the differences in handling change at the university as opposed to, say, in the corporate sector?
It goes back to what Ann's talking about. It's the type of change you're having. So one of the issues we had at Bank of America, whether it's the investment bank or the overall just consumer bank, when one firm buys another firm, it's a massive change. And one of the things that they know is there's something called musical chairs. Someone's going to get a chair pulled out from underneath them when they do consolidation. It's context-centric. What does that mean to that the people who are on the receiving end of the change? They had a totally different change experience than the people who were on the acquiring end of the stick. So mergers and acquisitions is one context for corporate America where there is someone is taking over, someone is merging. So if you're looking across the University of California by analog, where are there efficiencies and economies of scale to be made? You're going to see a similar potential for winners and losers. If there's two places you can get economies of scale, there's going to be, and this is on our campus, you get this thing, what's going to happen? I don't trust the new service provider. I don't trust the new organization. So the corporations face the same basic human principles, the sociological principles that were described here in corporate America. You know, the other thing is you're trying to do a new product launch. So you're trying to do something new. That's a very exciting change for those involved in the product launch. But one of the issues you'll see in corporate America, and you'll see this in the telephone industry, when the legacy telephone systems were being eaten by mobile. So there was AT&T and AT&T landline and AT&T wireless. The landline business was subsidizing a new line of business. So again, winners and losers. So I think my experience in corporate America change was there's been managing all the things that Tom and Chris and Ann discussed, but in the context of there being large constituencies of winning and losing. And that's a very tough thing because you need people who are being decommissioned to stay engaged while the new business models take over.
So I spent most of my career in the private sector, the last 6 years here at the university. Some of the things that are, let's say, unique to higher education, I don't know that I would say they're unique in terms of they're only higher education. I think part of it starts with a couple things. One, each organization is going to have its own culture. And we're large enough where we actually have subcultures. And even you could even say within some of our campuses, we have subcultures. And so I think understanding that corporate anthropology or, you know, organizational anthropology is important for understanding how to go about charting the change journey. The second thing was something that came across during just kind of my own research is there's research out there that shows that organizations that have higher tenure of employees tend to struggle with change more. And I think that really does describe an organization like ours. We have a lot of employees who've been here a long time. We're going to struggle with this more than an organization that's only been in business for 10 years and no one's been there more than 8. We are an organization that's been around a long time. We have a lot of calcified practices and we're going to struggle with these things. The other thing that I think makes change challenging in our environment, the last thing is that we have a highly individualist structure for how we run things. From one level, that makes it hard to get everybody to move. But on the other hand, I found that by being very individualistic, it also means that we have a lot of natural experimenters of people who are out there trying to move the needle because they're trying to create their own space, right? Their own voice. And so I feel like that part of what our role is as leaders here is to find those courageous individuals who are trying to create change and help them be successful and then help them figure out how to scale the success that they're trying to create. That's how I think leaders today help create the type of change culture at a place like the university.
What do you see as advantages and disadvantages of a centralized change management office if we went there in some way system-wide?
I'll jump in here real quick. I've observed this when I was at Bank of America. We had a change management practice at the center. And of course, there's 365,000 people they were trying to pull change into. And what I've seen is it's what I call the proximity to mission problem. Chris, Ann, Tom, and I have different situations in our locality. It's as Larry Conrad would say, I'll quote him, all security is local, for example. There's different risk tolerances, there's different regulatory regimes. The bank tried this homogenous approach to large systems change during the mergers and acquisition era, and it wasted millions of shareholders' dollars doing that because they were disconnected out of Charlotte, North Carolina, from the things in Los Angeles, from the things in San Francisco, from the things in Chicago that they were acquiring. They were just too distant. And that headquarters mentality missed a local set of problems. And it's not to say there's not a light level of support that needs to happen in terms of here's basic artifacts, here's the basic information, but it has to be propagated in a way that people closest to the local population can understand. So I'm putting a value judgment from my perspective, I haven't seen it work. I also saw that similar problem in the state of Tennessee when we were doing a lot of change from the state level.
Yeah, Matt, I would echo those remarks. Change is like politics, which is that all change is local. The fundamental question to improving that kind of change curve is what's in it for me, you know, or what does this mean to me? And so this is the challenge that all marketing and communications departments have. The big message from the CEO or the chancellor might get read, it might not. The message from my department chair probably has a higher likelihood, and the message from my immediate supervisor or peer is most likely to get digested. And so, you know, our communication activities around changes in our electronic health record, for example, are, you know, multimodal because we do large medical staff blasts, of course, but the ones that are really effective are the ones that are coming from peers in the same clinical service. And so we have a cascading approach for that communication that ensures somebody in the division is a super user and can carry that message forward in a way that's personalized for a given clinical service or practice.
I think as I understood the question, would a change management function located at the office of the president at the UCOP centralized, you know, be a good idea? Well, I think it's a good idea. I can imagine ways that it wouldn't be executed well. I can imagine ways it could be executed well, because I think what is true is that any given change does require understanding to the local context. So it really depends on what the change is.
That's true.
But if the project is, or the premise of the question is, do we need to manage change better within the UC? I don't think the implied inverse, that is, everyone goes off and creates their own change management center, is a solution either.
You know, I see some different models being used across the UC today from the vantage point that I sit in. I mean, if you take, for example, UCLA has stood up a business transformation office to chart a lot of what will ultimately be a lot of organizational change in the form of process changes that will replace old legacy systems with modern systems. And so that's kind of that central change management office that's driving the work and really kind of owning not just the change to processes, but also trying to take responsibility for how we have to treat the organization and prepare them for the changes that are coming. Very different approach from what's going on if you look at San Diego, for example, where they've invested into building what I would call like a new organizational muscle by putting literally thousands of people through Lean Six Sigma type training to build new competencies, and then creating forums like Process Paloozas, where they debate, large number of people can engage and debate the best process for the way we should work tomorrow. I would call that much more of a grassroots effort rather than a centralized approach. Both have their advantages and disadvantages. But I think, you know, to a certain extent, the culture of the campus should decide whether a centralized function versus a grassroots movement can work better for the challenges that they have.
I mean, I think that you have to recognize that you have a lot of the ingredients already, which is every health system and campus has a marketing and communications group. Those communications teams today, you know, exist and do meet. The challenge is that their goal is typically disseminating information, not supporting change. And they're taking direction locally. So there's a bit of a federated versus centralized tension. I also think you have to recognize that the health systems essentially exist as separate campuses with their own mission, vision, and goals. So it's a complicated beast, as Matt suggested. While you could take advantage of some of the infrastructure that's there already, better coordination would certainly help, but I don't think more centralized resources would help.
And I want to amplify what Chris just said, because if you look at a market composition, I don't know what San Diego Health's geographical market reach is, but the types of care, competitive institutions, saturation of certain disciplines and scale matter. At Santa Barbara, we don't have professional schools. We look uniquely very different than the rest of the UC. And so things here are different than worrying about a business school, a law school, a medical school, or a nursing school. We don't have that. Our Dean of the Graduate Division has an extraordinary place that's very different than the way in which a Dean's Council might work at UCLA.
I often hear this said, where we want to make a change, we recognize it requires a change in culture, and then we say, well, but our culture is so-and-so and so-and-so, as if it's some we're in a static place where that culture can't change. I mean, change is changing culture. So yeah. We can't have it both ways. We can't change our culture and then not have our culture change.
My experience, not all change requires a change in culture. Some change is just a change in which we do things.
Yeah.
Sometimes we are talking about changing culture. But I have to tell you that coming from being in multiple organizations before this one, I think our culture is not only pretty darn good, I think it's actually quite adaptive in a different way than a Facebook or a startup is adaptive. You have to be adaptive to be around for 150 years. We have not stayed the same for 150 years. We have adapted. We have a lot of built-in mechanisms that really challenge why do we need to change. But we also have a lot of risk-taking for people to experiment and try a new way to do things. Let's look at the active learning environments. We have all sorts of momentum on active learning environments. Is every faculty member wanting to do it? No. But every year you look forward, a larger percentage starts to adopt this new method that is being slowly accepted as being better than what we've been doing in the past. So I actually love our culture. We don't change fast. But the changes that we do make tend to stick. And I think that is what a institution needs to be from the standpoint of change.
Well, you know, you've heard that old adage about everyone wants change except the person who has to change. I mean, it's the same thing with culture. It depends on whose culture has to change. In a lot of ways, I think because we are so large and so variable, that does give us that strength to be, Tom referred to it as adaptive. You know, we can kind of move fluidly in a way that I think a smaller organization cannot. What we might not do is do it as intentionally or as coordinated, but I do see us as a system very responsive in very organic ways.
Recognizing, Chris, what you've talked about and Anne, you've said too, and I think, Matt, you even said the what's in it for me mentality and needing to address that from a leadership perspective. Related to that, what would you see is the most important aspect of communication during some large or even small scale change?
I don't have a fancy academic framework, but I have something from the shampoo industry that I like to bring to bear. I call it the PERT principle. Get a good message. Get it solid, get a lot of people to form the message with you, and then lather, rinse, repeat. Lather, rinse, repeat. It's the holy trinity of lather, rinse, and repeat. You've got to have the message out in 150 modalities, infographics, short-term, long-term. People land their message different, so you formulate the message, get it for different types, and then lather, rinse, and repeat. Micro or macro, you've got to be a consistent, repetitive message.
You have to follow through, you know, you have to sort of say, here's what we're going to do. And then you got to do it. And then you got to point to people out to people that you did it. I think that really that building that credibility when you're making a change is essential. And then I think you just have to ask people directly, will you come on board? Will you be part of this change? If not, what are your concerns? So you just have to be very clear and direct and genuine and authentic and follow through.
I may be the outlier on this one. I guess I have my own strategies for how to deal with the what's in it for me. I really try to move people off the topic of what's in it for me and really come back to what's right for the organization and why the organization exists. So I know it's, you know, I know there's a lot of what's in it for me, and that's a very kind of natural reaction, but we exist here at the university to provide the opportunity for education, the opportunity for social mobility, the opportunity for people to live their lives to their fullest. When people come to me with, you know, this is going to be bad for me, I try to pivot the conversation to what's good for the University of California and the people that it serves. I think that's what leaders have to do, or we get dragged down to kind of a tit for tat argument. I think we got to stay focused on what's right for the organization, because as leaders, we represent the entire organization.
What is the best strategy for recognizing and dealing with resistance to change?
Being helpful, facilitating solutions, understanding the root of the resistance. I think it's a kind of, for lack of a better term, it's a kind of ministering that you have to do to help people understand, you know, what is preventing acceptance of this change. Rarely is there no reason, and often the reason may not be clear or even one that someone can easily recognize or identify. And so being careful not to humiliate people or make them feel like they're laggards in some way, but really trying to facilitate an understanding through the transition that you're trying to achieve. So you have to really connect with people on a human level.
I'll flip the script, and I'll use a situation here at UCSB, and I got one at Vandy. I go around the resistance. So we were moving to, when I arrived on campus, we had 50 different email systems, 50 different calendaring, email. They were all spread out. Over the course of 3 years, we now have one. So to Ann's point, I said, fine, I gravitate to the willing. I start with the willing. And then as you gain critical mass, it puts a pressure on those who are trying to opt out, because you have this critical mass of people doing this adoption or this change. Did the same exact thing with Vanderbilt email. Critical mass tends to bring outliers along. And then you could find that there are legitimate reasons for some units not to come over to that platform.
Actually, that's a good point. You know, I think there it can be tactically useful in cases where you're making certain kind of changes to simply stop facilitating the system or the condition around which the resistance is centered. So if someone wants to run their own email server, fine, good luck with that. Spend your resources on that. I'm going to be busy doing this thing where I'm getting more institutional value and bang for my buck. You're on your own. Eventually, people sort of have an awareness and realize how tedious it is to be outside that critical mass. But it's a judgment call because it depends on the political conditions. It depends on the nature of the change.
Yeah, I think this points to, I don't think organizational change gets enough credit for how much strategic thinking goes into navigating a large, complex organization through change. Yeah. I mean, we talk about strategy as it's always this kind of external, we're studying strategy in the market, product placement, service offering. There is a lot, and I think CIOs, we sit in the middle of this world in the fact that we have these kind of internal and blended external and internal and external components to our roles. We spend a lot of time strategically thinking about how to move the ball forward, left, right, up, down, around. Change is a lot about strategic thinking and playing the chessboard properly, moving the right pieces in the right order with the right coalition of partners.
How do you take into consideration, you know, as you're moving the chess pieces around, if you're trying to get buy-in, change is happening, and then lo and behold, you find that maybe the change needs to be rethought, potentially even pulling the plug on the change. How does that factor into your decision-making and how you think about the people management aspect?
You know, I can think of a couple of times in my career, right, where the plug should have been pulled earlier and I didn't have the courage or maybe the awareness that continuing to beat the organization's head against the wall was just not going to work, right? I think there's some experience that helps you kind of understand if you're on a path of success or if you're on a path of futility. Part of the burden of leadership is you're confronted with courageous situations where you've got to make those tough calls. Hopefully you have people around you and you give them an environment where they're allowed to speak truth to you. I think a lot of leaders get caught where they don't allow people around them, especially deeper in the organization, to approach them with truths. They're blind to some of those situations. But what you really want is to, you know, again, have a sense of, are we on a path that we can be successful? And if we're not, what do we do from here? Do we pull the plug? Do we re-pivot? Do we call a timeout? Do we bring in a third party to do an external objective assessment of what we've been doing and if it's the right thing? There are a lot of different levers you can pull. Again, it's very strategic. But it starts with having good information flowing to you about if the things you're doing are being effective or not.
Yeah, I think with these large organizational changes, you know, we're used to thinking big, large, and systemically. And it really is, there's a lot of things that we have to change incrementally. And you have to be willing to recalibrate when you get more information. We often don't have all the information we need. You get a little bit more. It points to a new direction. And you've just got to sort of say, hey, look, with this new information, now it looks like the change needs to do this. And I think as Tom pointed out, it is a tough call from a leadership point of view, but that's what we're supposed to do.
Yeah, I would go back to a point that Tom made earlier, but I think it's worth re-noting that it's very clear from literature that organizations with highly tenured employees tend to go through change processes more slowly. Yeah. And the University of California has some very long tenured employees, particularly on the faculty side and also on the staff, because of benefits that we offer that similar institutions in the state don't also offer. And so it's been my observation that coming from a private university, there's less awareness of how things are done in other institutions because there tends to be more internal movement, less hiring from the outside, some very long tenured employees. Therefore, the resistance to change or awareness of need for change may be lower. And so that just reiterates the importance of trying new things, testing things, as you described, Matt, and communicating not just about what our sister UCs are doing, but also about what our competition and collaborators in the state of California and across the country are also doing.
Well, I just was thinking about one of the things that Tom said, this concept of leadership being available to listen to all levels of the organization when there may be trouble afoot and maybe there's a need to rethink how a change is being done or whether it should be done at all. Do you have any thoughts about what the most important characteristics of the leader, or in this case, if it was one of you who were leading a change, what would be the most important characteristics for you to have when introducing and managing the change within your organizations?
Well, for me, I mean, I don't think you can over communicate about a change. You know, I was doing a change. This was like 3 years ago. I think it was when we were switching an LMS system, and we spent a lot of time communicating about it to the point that I had people complaining about the updates about the change coming. And I thought, okay, I've got it. Finally. So I think that consistent, disciplined, intentional communication driven by the desire to help people understand what in the heck you're doing is sort of my guiding principle.
And I'll amplify that with saying intentional is an operative word. And then I'll go and saying rather lather, rinse, and repeat. Thanks for the opportunity, guys. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. And Matt, I cannot thank you all enough. When I think of the CIOs, you know, I think highly technical communications, et cetera, but that's what this group of CIOs, that you have this really broad and rich perspective is so, it's very refreshing to me. I can just say, I'm really grateful for it. And I appreciate your time so much.
Well, good luck with your project. If there's anything else we can do to help, please don't hesitate to call upon us.
Yeah, thank you.
That brings our interview to a close. I want to thank Matt Hall, Ann Kowalczyk, Christopher Longhurst, and Tom Andriola, as well as my colleague Terry Winbush, for their participation in this discussion. The music in this podcast is Times Are Changing, from the amazing Chill Out Jazz Paradise.